call this joint interim committee on justice system revenues to order. It is March the 30th, 2010. Welcome everybody to the committee. Sorry we're getting started just a little late this afternoon. We had another meeting prior to this and pushed us a little bit ahead, but we'll try to work on schedule. And we're going to start off today with an informational meeting. John Borden will start and give us a review of the February 2010 special session.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. This committee made recommendations to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means for the 2010 February special session, and this is just a follow-up report on what Joint Ways and Means did and then what the full legislature approved. Before you is a brief memorandum, a two-page memorandum from our office on what I'll go through this afternoon. In summary, the legislature adopted all of the committee's this committee's recommendations to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means that were presented. In particular, there was the program change bill, which was House Bill 3696, and it did two major pieces. The first piece was it took care of the distribution methodology. So in summary, what that did was for an immediate distribution of House Bill 2287 revenue, when that revenue becomes available for legislative counsel for the Oregon Law Commission and the Council on Court Procedures, legislative committee services for this committee's expenses, and legislative fiscal office for the expenses to procure a contract with the National Center for State Courts. In addition, it retained the distribution methodology of 65% of the balance of the funds going to the Oregon Judicial Department and 35% going to the Public Defense Services Commission. Those amounts are up to the expenditure limitation approved by the February special session. So the second recommendation that was adopted by the legislature was in the budget reconciliation bill, which was House Bill 5100. And what that did was for the Judicial Department, increased their other funds expenditure limitation associated with House Bill 2287 by $15 million other funds. For Public Defense Services, increased their other funds expenditure limitation by $8.9 million. And then provided for the $50,000 in for this committee's expenses for legislative administration, and then the $100,000 of expenditure limitation for the Legislative Fiscal Office. In addition to what this committee recommended and what was adopted, there was further discussion and approval of a plan in Joint Ways and Means related to a potential shortfall in House Bill 2287 revenue. The Legislative Fiscal Office worked closely with Judicial Department and Public Defense Services and identified general fund savings that could be used in the event that House Bill 2287 revenue again does not materialize to the anticipated $39.6 million level. In addition, the legislature approved a special purpose appropriation, or set aside $3.5 million in general fund in the emergency board for public defense services in the event that the portion of their House Bill 2287 revenue does not materialize. So that's the one significant positive change that the legislature did outside of this committee. The last piece is there were two budget notes approved. One was from this committee, and it was approved exactly as presented for both the Judicial Department and Public Defense Services. And the budget note essentially has the two agencies coming back and reporting regularly to Interim Joint Ways and Means and the Emergency Board on such things as estimated versus actual revenue, other funds budgeted expenditures on their management actions. I should back up their other funds budget expenditures on applicable positions related to 2287, actual expenditures and applicable positions funded with 2287, caseload changes, and any management actions they needed to undertake to stay within available cash revenues for 2287. So some very stringent reporting requirements for these two agencies for the legislature to monitor how 2287 revenue is materializing and what actions they are taking. In addition, though, there was a second budget note that was approved that's asked the Judicial Department alone to report to the Emergency Board meeting closest to December 2010 on its use of internal general fund operating funds to fund any House Bill 2287 revenue. Again, getting back to this plan that was established that identified some internal general fund within the department, Judicial Department, that could be used in the event needed. The legislature will take into account all of the department's operating savings, general fund, and other fund balances prior to the final distribution of House Bill 2287 revenue during the 2011 legislative session. If House Bill 2287 revenues meet or exceed projected levels, the legislature may transfer excess House Bill 2287 revenues into the state general fund. And lastly, both Public Defense Services Commission and the Judicial Department did make reports before full Ways and Means on caseload trends and other reports as required. So with that concludes the summary, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
John, I'm going to start off with my question. The legislature will take into account all of the department's operation savings, other funds, et cetera, for the final distribution of those revenues during the 2011. What do you see the recommendation, not specific recommendations, because we wouldn't know those, but what do you see generally the recommendations covering that would come from this committee on the distribution of revenue?
Co-chair Vercher and members of the committee, the recommendations in March will be a reconciliation late in the biennium of what revenue has actually come in and what we project for those final few months, with maybe what we project for those final few months, and then what general fund savings maybe are within the department. So we're really looking at the recommendations coming from this committee, whether there'll be a need to make a recommendation for additional other funds expenditure limitation. So this will be the final reconciliation of all House Bill 2287 revenue at that point.
And will not come until the latter part of the session,
the
biennium.
It will be based upon the last quarter of this current biennium. We will probably, the recommendation of this committee flowing through, again, Joint Ways and Means, will probably need to occur relatively early in the 2011 regular session. So there will be a timing issue. We'll want as much information as possible on actual revenues that accrue. So, you know, we're looking for that March time period to make sure that, first of all, that if revenues materialize, everyone has sufficient expenditure limitation to continue operations through the end of the biennium.
Okay. All right. Other questions? John, Madam Co-Chair?
No, yes. Thank you.
All right. Senator Whitson.
Thank you. John, very similar question that I asked you a few minutes ago. With the $8.3 million potential reduction in general fund savings that the judicial branch has identified, I understand that $2 million of that is essentially in PERS savings that has been already disappropriated, which leaves about $6.3 million. Again, if you look at the in a 2010-2011 fiscal year, that $6.3 million is about 125 FTE. Can the judicial branch absorb that many positions and still remain open 5 days a week?
Co-chairs and Senator Whitsett, the Legislative Fiscal Office worked very closely with the Judicial Department and identified savings that should not impact FTE reductions, and I'll go through briefly some of them just to give you an idea of what they are. There are some debt service savings. There was a little more judge purse savings. There was a miscalculation that led to some additional general fund being available that can be taken. The Judicial Department has $1 million contingency fund that can be used.
What was that contingency for?
The contingency that they, co-chairs and Senator Whitsitt, the contingency that they set aside was in anticipation of 2287 revenue not materializing. There is an opportunity to fund shift $1.6 million of general fund to other funds related to their state government service charges. And then they identified some additional vacancy and furlough savings that could be achieved. This would be the bulk of the savings, about $2 million. The last thing is there are some caseload savings in their mandated payments. So they are anticipating at this point that these are early projections, but they're anticipating that some of their jury trials and the expenses associated with those jury trials may not materialize. So that would be $500,000 there. And I can provide the committee with more specific details of this plan. But again, it was worked out between the Judicial Department and Public Defense Services. And on Public Defense Services side, they identified $1 million in trial level savings, and they had a fund sweep of $500,000.
Thank you, John.
All right. Co-Chair Nathan.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Based on the explanation, I do have a question now. There are some things that we heard that revenue is coming in under projection, some cases where revenue was coming in over what might have been anticipated. And now you've mentioned a couple of things about, I believe you said the cost for jury trials may not be as much as had been projected, something like that. Could you tell us, or could you tell us who could explain to us what some of those drivers are that are causing some things to not happen as fast or not come in as projected? Are there fewer trials, or are costs just coming down? You know, what's going on out there in the real world that's influencing the revenue and the activity and demand on courts?
Co-chairs and Representative Nathanson, I can speak to it at a very high level, and perhaps others can help out. But if you look at the revenue projection that the Judicial Department will be presenting here next, one thing is of interest, and that is under the criminal surcharge is the category misdemeanors, and that was that category is underperforming significantly by 80% of revenue. So I think what we're seeing is in particular instances that enforcement activities perhaps at the local level are not occurring. And so I think that while we may be seeing civil caseloads, and again, I would hope that Mr. Lemon could speak more specifically to this, or Mr. Bray, while perhaps we're seeing civil caseloads increasing, some of the criminal caseloads, from my very limited understanding, are declining, especially for those lesser categories of crimes, misdemeanors in particular.
This is very interesting news. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, John.
Thank you, Senator.
And moving on, we're going to hear an overview. We're going to have the House Bill 2287 Revenue Report. Welcome, Mr. Lehman.
Thank you, Senator Bertrand. Co-chairs, members, my name is Phil Lemon. I'm from the Judicial Department and committee staff, here to give you an updated report on the revenue produced by House Bill 2287. And I'm pleased to report that things are better than they were last time we talked about this subject. Last time I came in and had the unpleasant duty to inform you that we were not meeting the expected revenue projections on 2287, and if the revenue I said was going up, and what we did was if it leveled off at that moment in time, we would collect 50% of the projected revenue. And that understandably caused quite a bit of concern all the way around. We are now we're now looking at about 60% of revenue. So we're continuing to climb. If we leveled off at today's levels, we would get about 60% of revenue. And so and really the increases have been, I haven't gone through line by line, but almost every category of fee that we are reporting, that we are collecting on, has improved. And so we're ahead of the game from where we were a couple months ago, almost across the board. Just as an example, on the criminal side, so misdemeanors, felonies, and violations, when I last reported to you, we were projecting being 59% of projections. We are now at 42%. And so we're gaining ground there. On the new civil fees in that category, we were at 51% below. Now we're at 43% below. And so in every major category, we have gained ground. We still need a little more time before we're able to sit down and talk about a projection for the full biennium. But we're improving almost across the board uniformly.
Well, perhaps it was a little premature earlier.
Well, Senator Berger, we wanted to give you an early notice that we didn't think we're going to get to 39.6. We still do not think we're going to get to 39.6. And so I possibly could have phrased it a little differently. But again, we don't know. We're still in a growth curve. We're still in the implementation phase. And we don't know when we're going to level off. And in addition, there were practice changes that we didn't anticipate from members of the bar, from the filings, that we're still need to work through and get some time before we can kind of give you an educated estimate and a formal projection on where we think we're going to end up overall. But we didn't want to catch you by surprise.
That's right. Co-Chair Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. We heard a very tiny bit of information, more anecdotal rather than, you know, a complete survey, that it seemed that fees were not necessarily being collected in a uniform manner system-wide because of the complication. They were new. It was very new in the term, if you will. So does part of this increased collection have to do with the courts have taken steps to make sure everyone knows what's supposed to be collected and how? Or we're seeing sort of like the administrative improvements, if not some of the other changes that we'd like to see?
Madam Co-Chair, Representative Nathanson, let me start and perhaps Mr. Bray can give you some more tangible and on the ground examples. Short answer question is yes. Keep in mind that when all this occurred, we had a brand new budget, we had a brand new and fairly complex fee system in 2287. We had almost 5,000 resentencing hearings that the legislature asked the courts to do to obtain savings for Department of Corrections. So there was an awful lot going on in a budget reduction environment. And that's not yes. meant as an excuse, it's just an explanation of the times we're living yes. in. So we did training, we worked with the bar, we now have some experience under our belts. Our business services section is monitoring collections by court, and so we can kind of see how each court has responded to these things, whether we're under or over in different types of fees. We're trying to match those up with case filing changes, with the practice changes. As Mr. Bray mentioned upstairs, we've had legal counsel do a frequently asked questions and trying to work with courts to ensure that these fees are being imposed and collected uniformly and consistently.
Sounds
Does that
good.
Answer your question?
That's a great explanation. Thank you.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Phil, if you actually do have a shortfall of 40% on 2287 revenue, then that would be approximately $16 million. And the judicial branch's share of that would be, in rough figures, about 10.5, and PDSC would be roughly about 5.5. So that exceeds your $8.3 million by about a little over $2 million. Do you have a contingency for that, but then still to remain open?
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, short answer is no, we don't have a contingency plan for what the scenario you presented. So let me explain, and Mr. Borden can help me if I'm missing something here. The legislature in the 2010 special session assumed their expenditure limitations to judicial branch entities, is it, we're now projecting or estimating, I should say, $30 million instead of $39.6 million. And so the reduction plans that we've talked about are based on that shortfall. And so the revenue report that I'm giving you today, again, is we're in growth mode. If we cap out and stay at that level, we're at a 40% reduction. But we think we're going to keep growing. We just don't know where we're going to top out and where it's going to level out. The assumption in the actions taken by the legislature is that we will end up with a $30 million net revenue instead of 39.6. So the contingency plan that Mr. Borden talked about that was approved by the special session, the supplemental session, is based on that $30 million and not the larger number that you just discussed. Mm-hmm. Is that?
Yeah, follow up, please.
Follow up.
Yes, the difference between what you're projecting at $30 million and what you're actually the projection off of 40% would be a $6 million difference. And if I'm hearing you, we don't really have a contingency if that $6 million does not materialize.
Madam Chair, Senator Whitsitt, that's correct. We still believe that we will be at very close to the $30 million estimate that we were working from in the supplemental session.
Okay, follow up. If I could, just speculate a little bit, and hopefully you're correct, but the longer we deny the possibility that that money doesn't come in, the more damage it's going to do if you have to focus all the reductions in 1 year, it doubles the problem with an FTE. If you have to do it in the last 6 months, it quadruples the effect. So, I'm just wanted to get that on the record, and I'm very concerned about that.
Madam Co-Chair, Senator, the Chief Justice is very concerned as well. He shares that. We are monitoring this, and that was part of the reason for the regular reporting both to the E-Board and Interim Ways and Means, is so the Judicial Department is reporting to the legislature, and we both are watching this very carefully as the money comes in, as the Judicial Department takes actions to prepare for any shortfall that appears likely. If we do have the fortunate experience of exceeding $30 million in collections, then we will be coming back to you likely and talking about that mix of general fund, other funds to get us through the end of this biennium and prepare for 11-13. But yes, we're keeping our eye very closely on this.
Thank you.
Thank you.
At what point will you feel comfortable making projections on the revenue coming in?
Madam Co-Chair, personally, I would say June 1 of 11. Excuse me, it's my attempt at humor. We need another few months. So I would say we would start looking May, June to see what we can really feel solid about. It's not going to take, I think, too much longer than that. But if things are still moving around a lot, that will tell us we're not quite settled, and we'll be a little nervous to give you a formal projection. Mm-hmm. But we'll start looking at that very seriously in May and June, and we'll keep you apprised on what we come up with.
Well, obviously those numbers are going to be extremely important to the committee.
Absolutely.
Okay. Other questions? All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Senator.
All right. Now we'll go to Dave Hendricks for an overview of the Oregon courts.
Chair Herger, Representative Nathanson, members of the committee, my name's Dave Hendricks from the Legislative Council's office, and I was asked to come today and kind of do a follow-up on the presentation I did at your first meeting when we talked a little bit about the different courts in Oregon, with today with emphasis more on the trial courts in Oregon. Specifically the circuit courts, the justice courts, the municipal courts, and the county courts, which are the three trial courts. The only one that's not included in there that would be considered a trial court would be the Oregon Tax Court, which limited jurisdiction court, and I'm not going to address that. If I always looked at the Oregon Tax Court as kind of similar to the circuit court with a limited jurisdiction just to tax matters, and so most of what I say about circuit courts also is applicable to the Oregon Tax Court. The first, you should have a couple of tables that I prepared, and I'm going to start from the one that looks like this, that's got the different courts along the side and then a few questions along the top. starting with the question, how many? And circuit courts, we have 36, one for each county. The confusing thing on that for a lot of people frequently is the fact that we have established judicial districts in this state for administrative purposes, where, for instance, one of the judicial districts has five counties in it, but is solely for purposes of administration and electing of the judges for those courts. I've always conceptually thought that we still have a circuit court in each of those counties, and no matter where you file your paperwork for a case, if you were going to file a case that was going to affect title in one of those five counties, for instance, you would still file it in the circuit court for that county. So I still view it as having 36 circuit courts, although some of those districts may in fact only have one judge for two counties. It's still two circuit courts that judge serves. Justice courts, we have 38. And this information is taken from the registry that's maintained by the Judicial Department on their website. We passed a law about two sessions ago that required them to keep this information and for the justice courts to provide the information. The 38 includes the new Clackamas County Justice Court, which was formed at the beginning of this year. So that should be pretty well up to date. Municipal courts, we have 141, also from the Justice Department's registry. We have in Oregon, I think it's 238 cities or somewhere in that neighborhood, so roughly two-thirds or 60%, somewhere between 60-70% have a municipal court for the city. And finally, we have the county courts, which are exclusively found east of the Cascades, and they are interesting in that they only exercise jurisdiction over juvenile and probate matters. And some courts, there are some that do both, there's some that do only juvenile, and there's some that only do probate. The county courts are interesting. Maybe just to give you a little quick background on it, all of our county governments here in the Valley consist of commissioners. I think between three and five commissioners, I believe, for county commissioners. In these county court counties, they have usually two commissioners and a county judge. And the two commissioners perform basically the same functions as a commissioner does in one of our five commissioner counties here in the Valley, in that they do the legislative and executive functions for the county. The county judge, on the other hand, is a true judge, elected for a six-year term, and performs the judicial functions, the juvenile and the probate. And then when they're done with that, they take that hat off and they move over and they're the third vote for the legislative and executive functions in the county. So I think when we first probably, the state was first created, I suspect we were all county courts for all the counties that existed at that time. And the county commissioner form of government is probably the more recent development with respect to how we govern in the counties.
I'd like to interrupt for just a moment.
Yes,
this is a wonderful explanation. I just wanted to let people know that right behind your table that you presented is some other information that staff has prepared, such as the number of courts per county. There's a couple of great maps, so you get to see how many of these things are spread in the different areas. So there's some other detail here available.
On your comment about the judge, I was unaware of that until I was in a group after I first came into the legislature from Eastern Oregon, and they referred to Judge Pryor, and I thought Judge Pryor was a judge, just like any other judge. I didn't realize that it was this format that you've just described, and I had never heard of that. And we do not have that in Coos County.
Judge Laura Pryor, of course, served as, I believe, one of the co-chairs of the commission on the legislature that came out with many of those recommendations two or three sessions ago, and is a well-known figure over, and I can't remember, it's over there by Hood River.
Wasco County.
Yeah, Wasco County.
Gilliam.
Pardon? Gilliam?
Yeah.
Gilliam County.
Gilliam. That's
okay.
It. That's it.
So those are that's the categories of courts we're talking about. And moving on through the table, the geographical jurisdiction, and you have to distinguish here between, you know, if you're talking, for instance, with respect to offenses, what kind of territory could one of these judges, one of these courts cover as far as where the offense occurred versus what type of offenses they might, which I refer to and is commonly referred to as subject matter jurisdiction. So looking at the circuit courts, geographical jurisdiction is statewide. Any circuit court has authority, jurisdictional authority, to hear a matter no matter where it occurs. Now we have rules, statutes that govern venue. Venue says, it really are rules that say, yeah, you got jurisdiction to handle it, but really that's not the best place to bring the action because we don't want people bringing actions in circuit courts where neither of the parties live or something like that. So we have venue rules that force you to file a case in a more convenient county, but every circuit court has jurisdiction throughout the state as far as whether or not they have legal authority to do it. The venue statutes may dictate another place. Justice courts, their geographical jurisdiction is countywide for offenses, but it is statewide for civil. I see nothing that would limit the ability of a justice court in one county to handle a civil matter that arose in the other. I presume they would also apply rules relating to convenient forum if someone tried to file one in an inconvenient court and say, you're in the wrong court, you need to go over there. And I don't know if that would happen very often, but I suspect that would happen if indeed someone tried to file one in an inconvenient forum. Municipal courts, they're strictly citywide. Their authority extends.
Representative Nathanson.
So I'm still trying to get a handle on why there are justice courts. If at least in theory they can do these civil cases, does that mean someone has a choice of, well, I could either do it in justice court or circuit court? And why? I mean, that seems redundant or something. Why?
Chair Nathanson, it's historical. Yes, I think that a plaintiff who has a case that they could choose between a circuit court and a justice court could choose, at least initially, to file the case in a justice court. Now, or in the circuit court, they could pick and choose. I think that to a degree that the defendant would have some say with respect to whether it stayed in a justice court,
mm-hmm.
at least with respect to matters where the amount in controversy was in excess of $750. And the reason I say that is because the defendant has a right to a jury trial in any case where the matter in controversy is more than $750. Many, many justice courts do not provide jury trials. And Judge Lemhouse of the Justice of the Peace Association is here today, and he'll be able to talk about that more later if you'd like to talk to him about that. So if this is similar to what happens in the small claims departments of circuit courts, I can file a case up to $10,000 in the small claims department of a circuit court. Well, there are no jury trials there. There are no attorneys in small claims department of circuit court. I can file it against the defendant, but if it's for more than $750, the defendant can come in and say, I don't like this, I want a jury trial, and they can force the plaintiff to move it into the regular department where the attorneys can show up and jury trials can be held. So there are certain limitations on the ability, it seems to me, to force somebody to go into a justice court, but certainly you can file it there, and people can waive the right to a jury trial. If everybody agrees, yeah, I'm fine with being here, the case can be tried in that court.
Another follow-up?
Yes,
follow-up. You mentioned $750, and I see $7,500 for the amount in controversy. Those are two separate topics, aren't they?
Chair, or Nathanson, they are. The $750 is their jurisdictional limit.
Okay.
Saying if you have a matter that's in dispute that's more than $750, you can't even bring it in the justice court. You would have to bring it in the circuit court.
Yeah, that's $7,500.
More than $7,500. Okay, then the other question then is I heard that, and I could have misunderstood this, but justice courts, if someone disagrees with the outcome, the way you appeal it is you start over in circuit court. Is that right?
Chair Nathanson, in general, that is correct. That is true in all justice courts, insofar as I know, and it's true in all municipal courts except for two. A few years back, we had a work group set up that went through a lot of work and enacted a law that created a mechanism whereby justice courts and municipal courts could become courts of record. Courts of records are just what they sound like. When you have a trial in a court of record, the proceedings are recorded, usually on audio tape. All circuit courts are courts of records, consequently, except for the small claims department, but all of them are courts of record. So if you try the case there, you have an audio record of what happened at the trial. That record is what you base your appeal on, and you go straight to the Court of Appeals. In fact, the Court of Appeals would not be able to do anything with it if you don't have that record, because they don't want to get into a debate about he said that, she said that. They want to have a record to review, and their review is limited. You're supposed to be looking for errors in the record. So justice courts, I was surprised when I went and looked, there are no justice courts that have opted to become courts of record, is from what I see here, which means that there is no record. There's no recording of the proceedings. The recording costs money. You have to set up the equipment. You have to have the tapes. You have to keep them. You have to be able to have a person present at the trial to run the tape recorder. So it's expensive for them to do that. But what that means is because there is no record, that if one of the parties is unhappy with the result in the justice court, their only avenue is to file the case to appeal in circuit court. They pay the filing fee that otherwise applies to cases filed in circuit court, and you start over, because at that point the decision of the justice court or the municipal court becomes moot. You basically retry the case anew from the start. Mm-hmm. If it's a violation case, the police officer will have to come back for that second trial in the circuit court in mm-hmm. order to get the decision. Now, they have a record there, and that party would then have an option of appealing again to the Court of Appeals based on the decision in the circuit court.
I'm going to make a couple of comments and just start ruffling a couple of feathers here, but I'm starting to wonder, on the one hand, maybe it seems efficient or convenient to have justice courts available throughout the state, but there are certain things they're not doing because it costs money. And the money that they collect, I'm assuming, doesn't get contributed to some of those statewide services that we maintain, like law libraries or certain other dispute resolution, some of those other functions that we think are important to maintain access to justice for all Oregonians. And yet, we have other courts that can do some of the same things. I'm just trying to understand why we have this duplication of services. systems.
Chair Nathanson,
but maybe it will.
I'll be talking about the money end of it here in the minute
okay.
on the.
Okay.
When I get to it, I'll kind of we'll go through the chart. I'll show you how the money flows.
Okay. I think my co-chair was.
That's all right. Move right on. That's fine.
Municipal courts, I have it as citywide there. As a practical matter, city police do issue violations outside the city, so I might have to qualify the geographical. If a police officer, a state police officer, spots a violation, they do have authority outside the city. I presume it's statewide. I don't know. I haven't looked into it that deeply. They don't do civil cases in municipal courts at all. They don't have jurisdiction to do it, so we're only talking about violations and misdemeanors in municipal courts. Finally, county courts is countywide, but as I said, we're only talking juvenile and probate in those courts. So, subject matter jurisdiction. I've divided it here between offenses, criminal, and then subject matter jurisdiction, civil. The circuit courts are the where everything goes in, except when a statute says you to go, you have to go somewhere else. So their jurisdiction over both subject matter and in both criminal and civil is plenary. You can go, they can handle any of these matters. Again, unless there is some law that sends the matter somewhere else. And an example of that would be tax matters, which go to tax court, land use decisions, which go to LUBA. There are some things that statutorily have been taken away from circuit courts and sent elsewhere, but unless there's a statute saying you're going to take this somewhere else, they have jurisdiction over it. Justice courts and municipal courts on offenses are the same in that they have jurisdiction over violation and misdemeanors, but not felonies. What actually happens on the ground is a little tougher, and again, Judge Glenhouse can address that. Not all courts, not all justice courts, and not all municipal courts take misdemeanors. Many of them take just violations. Many of them take misdemeanors, but they only handle the case up to the point where it looks like it's going to go to a trial, and at that point, it will bounce out into the circuit court. And the reason for that frequently is county to county based on what the district attorney likes to do, because the district attorney in the justice court and the city attorney in the municipal court get some say on where the cases are going to be tried, and many of them do not want to, would prefer to try them in circuit court rather down in the municipal or the justice court. So again, they have authority to do these cases. How many, whether they do them or not, some cases do everything. I don't know if how many of them go all the way through to trial. Misdemeanors are expensive. Misdemeanors involve indigent defense. Misdemeanors involve a right to a jury trial. These are things that cost a lot of money to provide. The ones that the counties that do them actually have, I was talking with Judge Limhouse before the hearing because I was curious, do have an indigent, they have their own indigent defense fund that they look to hire local attorneys. They do not go through the state's system for providing indigent defense, but instead use local attorneys, et cetera, to handle them. But again, not all of them necessarily will go to a trial. They, in some degree, they operate to a degree like the way I remember district courts used to operate when I was first starting practice, where the district attorney filed felonies in district court for purposes of arraignment, and it was only after you got through the arraignment to the point where you were asking for a trial that it bounced over to circuit court. And it, when I was listening to the way it works in some of these justice courts, it sounded very similar to the way that used to work as well. Justice courts do have civil jurisdiction of up to $7,500 in controversy. I think based on what I've been told, many of them do exercise that jurisdiction and do provide that option for parties to come in and to try those cases. Again, many of them will not provide a jury trial, and so if the parties want a jury, if one of the parties want a jury trial, they're going to be in the circuit court. With respect to whether they need to be the attorney, circuit courts, that's a qualification for the office. You have to be an attorney, a member of the Oregon State Bar, to be a circuit court judge. Justice courts and municipal courts, you do not, unless you become a court of record. That was one of the provisions of the bill I worked on. And as I said, two of the municipal courts have become courts of record, and I presume they have attorneys serving there. I know that many of the municipal courts and justice court judges are attorneys. I don't know what percentage out of the totals, out of the total 38 and 141 are attorneys. The next to the last question there is constitutional judge, question mark, elected 6-year terms. If you're a constitutional judge, you have certain protections built into the Constitution. A, you get elected, you have to be elected. You have a 6-year term, and you cannot have your compensation reduced during the term of your office, which was put in there to obviously to protect judges from being punished from popular decisions. And so circuit court judges are, of course, constitutional judges, and they, you know, once they're in for their 6-year term, they're protected for that period. That's also true of justice courts. They're elected for 6 years as well. They are not elected by the full county. The justice courts are allowed to establish up to 6 justice of the peace districts with geographical boundaries within a county. Some of them basically take in the whole county. The new Clackamas County Justice Court is described as being all of the unincorporated areas of Clackamas County. So they have one district that's consisting of basically the whole county except for those areas that have been incorporated as cities. But you don't have to do that. You can have up to 6 districts where you have smaller chunks with boundaries, and only the people within that district vote for that justice of the peace. And one of the things that I saw in the materials that were handed out that surprised me is that some of these districts indicate that they have like 7 judges. Now, I don't know for sure. My best bet is that, in fact, there's 1 justice of the peace and probably 6 pro temps, because justice of the peace courts use pro temps the same as circuit court. So I suspect that what's going on there is that they have people who come in, you know, part-time or on an hourly basis to help out with the cases. Funding, obviously, circuit courts from the general fund, as we've discussed at length. Justice courts, they're funded by the county, from the county fund. Municipal courts, funded by the city, as you might expect. And then finally, the county courts are, of course, also out of the county general fund. So that gives you the big picture. And I'll ask if you have any questions on that big structure. I'll move on in a moment here to the funding and the money and how it all works.
Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you. Ms. Hendricks, to follow up on Co-Chair Nathanson's line of questioning, is there a way to determine the relative cost for the resolution of a case in a justice court or a municipal court as opposed to a circuit court? And is there any record, the second question, is there any record from a justice court or a municipal court on the percentage or how many cases are appealed or moved over to the circuit court?
Chair Verger, Chair Nathanson, Senator Whitsitt, on your first question, I suppose you could take a triad. I suspect that there's not a lot of difference, and it depends on the type of case you're talking about to some degree. Most of what these local courts do are tickets, traffic tickets. In circuit court, every circuit court now has a violation bureau,
which handles tickets, which is judges do not become involved with unless people show up and ask for to have a trial. And when they do show up, more likely than not, they're going to be before a referee or a pro tem judge. They're not going to be before one of the judges we're paying a lot of money for in salary. And that's pretty much true, I suspect, as well, pretty much exactly what happens in the Justice Municipal Court. Most of the cases get handled by a staff, clerical staff, because most people, when they get a ticket, just send in the check. And so they probably get handled there by clerical staff with maybe some input from the judge. Obviously, the judges in those courts get paid less, but again, usually we don't have our circuit court judges hearing. We have pro tems and we have referees hearing this matter. Maybe Mr. Bray can probably tell you about how that works in Multnomah County, but I presume you do not have the regular judges handling traffic matters, or do you?
Madam Co-Chairs, in Multnomah County, we use attorneys who are hired by the court as hearing referees, but who have appointments from the Supreme Court. They've been approved by the Supreme Court for 3-year terms to sit as judges pro tem. And they are appointed to sit and they preside over traffic matters in the circuit court in Multnomah County, small claims matters, landlord-tenant matters, and matters of that nature, so that the regular judges, the regular circuit court judges, are freed up to do the felony misdemeanor and general civil family law caseload.
But for purposes of this committee, because the circuit courts are funded out of the general fund and the justice courts are funded from the counties, unless they move into the circuit court, that doesn't influence our revenue stream. In other words, so would we be any better off, for instance? You don't have justice courts in Multnomah County. So if they took away all the 38 justice courts, a lot of that could do exactly what Multnomah County does, which would then fall under the revenue stream of the general fund.
Co-chairs, I think that observation is correct. However, I think that the culture of having justice courts and the way those courts are linked to their community create some value locally for those individuals in those communities to have that resource. For instance, Multnomah County, you observed correctly, has no justice courts, has 3 small municipal courts, and even the City of Portland, City of Gresham don't operate a municipal court. All of that work comes through the circuit court, and we handle all of that. That's the smallest geographic jurisdiction in the state. In those counties where they have justice courts, often it's because of the geographic remoteness of the circuit court, perhaps from the area where the justice court is created, that makes it an efficient vehicle for them. So there are issues to weigh if we look beyond simply the efficiency of providing a forum for those services.
Well, and I think that for our purposes, what we wanted for today, and thank you very, very much for providing this overview, is that we're trying to get as much information. We want to make sure that everybody is on the same page in the committee, that we all understand exactly what we're talking about when we're talking about a system. At some point, we get down to the nitty-gritty of connecting the dots. And efficiencies are one thing, or what it means in a community, and I think, as he points out, that's very likely very true, really isn't the purview of our committee. But at some point, as we discuss how the general fund is going to work and how this whole system is going to be funded, we've got to have a very clear understanding of exactly what's happening even outside of our revenue source.
Chair Verger, that's correct, and I think that when I get to this next page of the presentation, you'll see that when you start looking at the fine piece, you do need to understand how these local courts come into play with respect to it, because there are different ways to do these things and different impacts with respect to how the money flows. So I think it would be important to look at that and get you started looking at that now. Senator Witz had asked a second question about how many appeals there are. I don't know. Anecdotally, I hear not very many from these courts to the circuit court. I don't know how much of that is attributable to the fact that if you've got a $100 fine, you're going to be willing to pay the filing fee in circuit court to appeal that, when the filing fee is probably going to be $150,
$160.
$197. Yeah, right. So, you know, you'd have to be pretty mad about your ticket outcome.
Yes, Senator Witz.
And David, one further question just came to mind. In the justice courts and the municipal courts, do they generally create a revenue stream for the local jurisdiction, or are they a net cost to the local jurisdiction?
Chair Verger, Senator Witz, my impression is that they probably generate a revenue stream. And I only say that because, well, you'll notice that Clackamas County just formed one. Clackamas County is having troubles as well as every other county in this state is with budget. I don't think there's a local government in the state can sit back and say, gee, we're doing great. And if you'd read the Oregonian story about that, it was pretty clear that the reason it was being formed was to generate revenue for programs that they wanted to do.
Thank you.
All right. We'd better move on here for the time.
Okay. If I can quickly go through this second sheet. Now, you should be looking at one that looks like this, and I apologize because one got sent out by email yesterday that was an early version. It should have three things down along the side with who's issuing the citation and then the courts on top. And this is very important for later purposes for talking about how you might want to change with respect to increases or changes to traffic matters. This is the chart that's based on ORS 153-630 that says what happens when you write your check, you've gotten a ticket somewhere, and you write a check and you send it off to where you've been told to send it, because it's going to be on the ticket. It says, here's your base fine amount. If you don't want to show up on this thing, you send your check to this place. And the question is, well, where'd that money go? You know, that I wrote that check for. And what this table does is tell you where it goes. And the simplest one is up in the upper left-hand corner. You know, you got issued a citation by a state police officer, and he said, send your money to the Marion County Circuit Court. So you send it to Marion County Circuit Court, and 100% of the fine amount on that is going to go to the general fund. Simple enough. And in addition, there's going to be a unitary assessment, and 100% of that is going to go to the general fund. And in addition, there's going to be a $45 surcharge under 2287, and that's going to go to the general fund as well. So that's the simplest. The next scenario, if you drop down one, is what if a sheriff, a county sheriff, deputy sheriff, pulls you over? Now, if the sheriff does that and the sheriff says, go to circuit court, what's going to happen when you get there is of the fine amount, 50% is going to go to the county, 50% is going to go to the general fund.
The state general fund, not the county general fund.
Correct. And the unitary assessment will still, of course, go to the state, and so will the 2287 surcharge, because we said that the surcharge goes to the general fund if it's imposed in circuit court. However, and that's what would have happened last year in Clackamas County, because there was no justice court in Clackamas County, so all of the citations that were issued there by the sheriff or deputy sheriff were sent to the circuit court. And that's what would have happened. 50 to the county, 50 to the state of the fine amount. Now, if you go to the next one, if the
Oh, Representative Nathanson.
I have a quick question. So does that mean that once this court was established, did the circuit court have to approve the establishment of it? But the circuit court or the court system now has a decrease in revenue that
Chair Nathanson, the court itself doesn't experience a decrease in revenue, but
the general fund does.
To the extent that tickets go to the justice court, because what happens is the sheriff will direct the deputies to send these tickets to the justice court, and you will be under the second box there over sheriff or deputy issue citation. It goes to the justice court. 100% of the fine amount will go to the county. The unitary assessment will still go to the general fund, but the 2287 surcharge will now go to the county fund, because we said that if the surcharge was imposed in a county court, it would go to the county. So, you know, that's the structure. This statute has been in effect, I think, since the 90s, because there used to be big battles about, and this was the big compromise about how to deal with who issued the ticket versus who got the fine that were generated by the ticket. You'll note again that in the justice court, they will collect the unitary assessment and they will forward that to the general fund.
Paula?
Yes. Madam Co-Chair, what that says to me is if we're trying hard to figure out how to create a stable and predictable system of revenue, if someone else can just influence that without our participation, that's something we have to factor in.
Such as this.
Okay.
Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Still trying to understand this table. Dave, so what, I'm still unclear about what, let's assume in the upper left-hand example, the citation is issued by the state police officer. The determination about whether that's referred to circuit court or justice court or municipal court is at the discretion of whom and using what criteria?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Garrett, as far as I know, it's at the discretion of the officer. Again, anecdotally and just based on some conversation I had before the hearing, to some degree, I think it's driven by the whether or not what's most convenient for the citizen, and sometimes perhaps what's most convenient for the police officer as far as appearing on the ticket, because in the officer's mind, he's thinking, where am I going to have to show up if this thing goes to a hearing? And so I think that now in the sheriff, in the scenario under the sheriff, you know, my impression has always been that probably the sheriff would direct their deputies to issue the citation to the justice court. The sheriff of Clackamas County was quoted extensively in the Oregonian story and was much in favor of this proposal, and I presume that that's what has happened. It will happen, because otherwise it doesn't make sense. That's the way it works. Now, I want to say this before we go any further, because, you know, I've been involved with this topic since 1989. And here are some of the issues that you deal with. Looking at the lower right-hand corner, the last box in the corner, what you see down there is what I refer to as the Coburn exception to the city citation, Coburn. And in 2003, we had hearings about the situation in the city of Coburn. And what just the short version of this was this, is that the city of Coburn would regularly send, on a regular basis, had its city police officers stationed on I-5 to issue citations on I-5. And I-5 wasn't within the jurisdiction of the city of Coburn. And when they held, the legislature found out, they thought that was a bad idea and said, look, we don't want to have cities having any authority to go out. And if you do send someone out and they issue a citation, 50% will go
to the city and 5th go to the state, not 100% to the city, which it normally would in a, if it, under the normal rule of things here. What was, you know, what they found out at that time, that the city of Coburg's budget was over 50% funded by fines from its police department. And I suspect there are a lot of cities whose, these fines make up a very large percentage of their budget. And it's probably true that it makes up a good percentage of some of the county budgets as well. If you shut down all these courts tomorrow, you would have a big, 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 big problem, because you would have lots and lots of cities with, in counties in far worse shape than they are now. And I believe that to be true. I mean, certainly that's what happened with Coburg. Coburg, after we passed the law in 2003 that said, if you issue a citation outside of your boundaries, promptly went out and annexed a piece of property on I-5 so that it was within the boundaries. The legislature took that up in 2007 and took no action with respect to it because their budget is so, you know, some of the budgets are so dependent upon fines on some of these that it will be a big problem to backfill the hole for the local governments.
Well, some Oregon drivers are very cooperative in my area. They contribute very well to the Reedsport Municipal Court. Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess a comment followed by a question, if I could. This comes across, all of this, as a patchwork of a court system that has evolved over time through history for reasons of any number of reasons other than rational design, I guess. And so I guess at least the question has the legislature previously undertaken an effort to look at this system? And I know that in the 80s we went to what we've called the unified court system. We haven't heard a lot about that in this committee. It might be helpful if you could explain what that meant and what was looked at, and was it, were any of these questions we're grappling with dealt with at that time? In other words, does what appears to us to be kind of a confusing mess of a system reflect actual deliberate decision making, or has it really just evolved over time through accident, if nothing else?
Chair Berger, Chair Nathanson, Representative Garrett. What's happened, I think, to some degree is that these courts serve a different function than perhaps they did at statehood. Justice courts go back all the way, and I suspect municipal courts do as well, all the way back to 1857, probably before, for all I know. In 1981, we went to a unified court system where the state stepped in, and up to that point, the counties operated the circuit courts. And the counties paid the judges and the staff, and they paid the district attorney. And when the state stepped in, they said, we're going to try to not have 36 fiefdoms out here of individual duplicative sort of work. We're going to have a centralized administrative structure. The state will pay the salary of the judges and the staff, the administrative staff. The state will pay at least the base portion of the district attorney, although not the deputy district attorneys. The state would pay indigent defense, which up to that point had been a county responsibility. The one thing that the counties were left with was the responsibility to provide the courthouse, which made sense because the courthouse was a mixed-use facility usually. The county commissioners met there, a lot of the administrative structure of the city was located there, and they were to provide the courthouse. And the statute says it should be suitable and sufficient facilities. Well, I've been to lots and lots of meetings about that one as well over the years because of the problem that is presented. That unification pretty much said, local courts, we're not having anything to do with it. Right now, the Supreme Court has authority over justice courts for only two purposes. One is discipline of the judges. They are constitutional judges. So in Article 7, Section 8, which says how you can go about disciplining a judge. The only way you can go about disciplining a judge, if you want to do something with a justice of the peace, it has to be done through the Supreme Court process. The only other thing they do is we passed a law that said that when we went to, we required justice of the peace to have continuing education. And we told the Supreme Court by law that they would take care of that and supervise that piece of the puzzle. Other than that, there's more or less hands out. But during the 90s, especially when I first started here, there were lots of bills about this, about the justice courts, about the revenue issues with respect to them, et cetera. A few things passed, things like excluding justice courts from the county seat, et cetera, and various other things. In general, and then there was this large compromise about how the fines were going out, because I don't know how it worked before they passed this, but this laid out at least a structure to say where the money went. So has there been some sort of big look at trying to structure this thing from the ground up?
No.
And as I say, because of the more, I guess I would call it revenue sharing aspect of the system, you know, you would have to address that. It would cause, I see that the Clackamas County, I think they said they were going to have 7 full-time employees in that justice court. A lot of these other courts have quite a few employees as well. They would be out of work. You would have a lot of other people who are funded by the revenues that the city takes in. They would be laying off people. It would be difficult to do it without somehow or other backfilling some of this for some of these local governments. So anyway, the table here, this is the way it currently works. I believe this is a correct statement of how the distribution system works. It's significant for looking later on at changing the traffic offense materials, because as you see, if you just raise the fines, for instance, for traffic offenses, it has flow through to cities and counties. If you raise the unitary assessment, it doesn't, because that goes to the state. So, you know, this at least gives you an idea. And someday I hope to get a flow chart on infraction and violations. Generally, I promised you a long time ago, but we haven't quite got there to talking about those really. But this is a key piece of the puzzle when you start looking at the way that general fund money comes in through the issuance of traffic citations.
Right. Any other questions? I would like to move on. We need to look at the work plan. Mr. Hendricks, thank you so very much. Next item on our agenda is the review and discussion of the committee work plan. And I believe, John, you'll be conducting this with us.
And you will find at your at the dais a large graphic chart, and we sent out a minimized chart with the material history just so you can see the key policy questions and core principles. But this will be our primary work plan document.
Good afternoon, co-chairs and members of the committee. This is the draft work plan that Ms. Seiler is referring to, and it's for the committee's pleasure to consider. And what we tried to do as staff was get together and map out what it is from our understanding of the direction the committee would like to go to achieve its the long-term objective of the committee. And so, again, these are our words that could be fine and tuned and tweaked by the committee. That's why we called it version one. And I apologize, there's not draft on here. But this is the roadmap to get us through this interim as a suggestion from staff. It starts off with an overarching policy question, and then an overarching policy objective. There are 5 major categories of policies that should be considered: core principles, key policy questions, and then to be filled in, best practices, how achieved, how measured, and discussion dates. In general, the intent is to try to tackle each one of these five topics under major policy categories at one meeting of your committee, so that as we go through, as the committee goes through and considers these policy categories and considers the core principles from which it would operate and the questions at hand, we would be able to complete out the rest of this work plan in somewhat of a measured manner, and also that this would flow nicely with what the National Center on State Courts is doing, so that we could take their input as well as other public input from individuals that would be providing public testimony to your committee to help complete this chart, so that at the end we have your committee has an idea of what solution they're after. So, Madam Co-Chair, I would be glad to go through this in more detail, or whatever your pleasure is.
I think we will go through it. I just, in looking at it, I guess, John, the thing that really concerns me as one of the co-chairs of this committee is that we maintain the enthusiasm of our members. And if we bog down in a lot of minutiae, and then we are not able to move forward at every meeting where the committee feels satisfied that we're actually accomplishing things and reaching our goal, we will lose that enthusiasm. One of the things on your work plan, go down to the very last comment under revenue restructuring, it's the judicial branch should have adequate and stable funding. And to me, that almost should be all the way across the top of the page, because that's really where we're trying to get to. And as you work through this, I want you to bear in mind to help your co-chairs, so that we are not spending time looking at, for instance, a number of fees that in the end of the day, we may not even accept them at all. And I think we will have gone through all of that work plan without accomplishing anything. So a lot of this is pretty generic. I mean, it's not, you know, too specific. But let's walk through it and see what the committee questions are. But I want us to be able to have a timeline. In other words, I believe the people that are doing the study are going to be here. I don't know if we're going to have an opportunity to meet them. If so, I think that would help maintain the enthusiasm of the committee. I think getting their report back will do it, getting the projections on how the revenues are coming in. But if we can just keep all of this coming along and moving, we'll be fine. If not, we're not going to accomplish a lot, and we'll bog down into kind of the yin-yang of probably plowing too many fields that have already been plowed.
Senator Verger and members of the committee, this is exactly where the staff was feeling that our recommendations to you are coming from, and that is that this is the breadth of this topic is quite large, and that it needed to be narrowed, and there needed to be consensus that we understood where your committee would like to go, and so that we can assist in achieving these goals. So this is not a very attractive spreadsheet, but we're trying to do one-stop shopping to just lay out the major issues so that we can have all of us can work off the same sheet.
And I appreciate your work that you've done on this, John. So start through it with us.
Okay. We start off with the overarching policy objective, which is, does the current revenue and fee structure affect access to justice and the administration of the judicial branch? Then we move down to the overarching policy objective. And if I may, co-chairs, if there's suggested word changes or anything else, if you would let us know, you could email them to us, or we could, however you'd like to work through this, we can. Otherwise, I'll just kind of read what we have. The overarching policy objective, the legislature is responsible for funding the judicial branch and is responsible for establishing a statutory framework for revenues. Oregon should implement a judicial branch revenue and fee structure that is equitable, understandable, transparent, and stable to ensure the independence of the judicial branch and to ensure that the cost of using the state courts is appropriate to the benefits received.
I have a question. Has the judicial branch ever presented their own budget just like the governor does?
Co-Chair Verger and members of the committee, I will give you my limited perspective. Perhaps others like Robin could speak to it, but the important thing to understand about that particular question is that the governor presents a unified budget for the executive branch, in other words, all agencies. So right now, the judicial branch does not present a unified budget, even as it's incorporated into the governor's recommended budget when it comes through. So to my knowledge, the judicial branch has always provided their budget to the governor as it's initially come through. And the reason why is to help Oregon and make sure that the governor fulfills his duty to arrive at a balanced state budget. The legislative branch also does the same thing. They provide their budget to the governor, and the governor doesn't make any judgment calls on decisions, but if there are on those particular branches of government, but what he does do is if there are reductions required, reductions are prorated across those specific budgets.
Madam Chair, I wanted to clarify. The judicial branch submits, the judicial department submits its own budget, and the Public Defense Services Commission presents its own budget. The chief does not present a unified budget that incorporates both of those budgets. But the chief does present his own judicial department budget to the legislature.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you for that. All right, John.
So the overarching policy consideration and then the overarching policy objective. From there, we have five major categories that we felt needed to be addressed. The first, the statutory revenue structure. The second, revenue. The third, revenue administration, including distribution and collection activities of the department. The fourth, implementation. And the fifth, revenue restructuring. So on the first category, statutory revenue structure, the core principle that we thought needed to be identified was a revenue structure should be transparent, equitable, and fair to court users and beneficiaries. And the policy questions that arise from that are the following four. Is the current revenue structure transparent and easy to access and administer? Does the current revenue structure affect access to justice? Is the revenue structure equitable and fair to users? And should the revenue structure include an automatic adjustment for inflation?
Any questions on the first section? Okay. Move on.
Madam Co-Chair?
Senator Bonamici, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I wanted to just make a point about does the current revenue structure affect access to justice? I think any revenue structure in some way is going to affect access to justice. And I think what we need to do is figure out does it at what point is it an adverse effect that is not sustainable.
Great.
So just maybe a nuance that I think we should keep in mind. Thank you.
The second category is revenue. And the core principle is the types and level of fees should not hinder access to justice, so adversely hinder access to justice. The key policy questions are, does the type of fees affect access to justice? Do the type of fees affect access to justice? Does the magnitude of the fees affect access to justice? Are sources of revenue easily identifiable? Is there a clear nexus between revenue recipients and the purpose for which fees are imposed? Now, there's some crossover between some of these categories, so we can work through that if necessary, but mm-hmm. some of these are somewhat reoccurrent, as you'll see, and we had to just kind of place them where need be. So.
And we have a court case that was given to us where someone challenged the fee structure. So Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I have a comment on two of those policy questions. The second one, about the magnitude of fees, I think there are two things here. One is the number of fees. So for one thing someone's trying to get resolved, you may pay a fee and then another fee and then another fee and then another fee. So the fact that multiple fees exist may be a problem. I'd like to know that. And then the other is the cost, or the price, if you will, the price tag on the fee, you know, $1 versus $100 versus $1,000. So I'd like to make sure we're aware that both of those may affect it. And then on the last point, it's starting to dawn on me that the way we say certain kinds of fees that are collected on the civil side go to pay for certain things, and then certain kinds of fees that we collect on the criminal side pay for other things, it's not making a lot of sense to me. And I think that's what this question is. Is there a nexus? Right. Because some of those things collected on the civil side go to things that I know benefit the criminal side also, and vice versa. So that is that what we're going to get at here with that question?
Yes. And
is that what
co-chairs and Representative Nathanson, I think, and the staff can weigh in too, the rest of your committee staff can weigh in, but we want to make sure that there, that nexus, if it exists, is clearly understood. So there are certain instances where fees are connected to the services provided, I think limited, more to your point, there are most of the existing fees are not that way. They're for general, the revenue is for more of a generalized purpose.
Madam Chairs, it's both your issue and the issue of fees that are collected that go to a separate function that is, and I won't single anybody out, but there are fees that are collected for purposes that are not, that may not, I don't want to prejudge, be directly related to the purpose for which the fee or the surcharge is collected.
Well, that probably doesn't make the payer very happy. That's the main thing. If you're paying for something and it's not, and there's not a nexus, usually people are not particularly pleased about that. So I'm going to turn it to Senator Whitsett. He has a question.
Actually, kind of two. The first, House Bill 2287, essentially, I believe it was required a 60% majority because it was a tax. It's a fee that has no nexus as to what it's collected for. It is, goes to the general fund for the purpose of supporting the whole court system. And it'd be interesting to dive down into some of the other fees that have been created through the years and how much of that money actually goes to the nexus for which it was designed to, and how much of it ends up in the general fund and remains there. And the second question, or the second point, is that in visiting with Mr. Lehman and Sarah Gates and others, it appears that administration costs of collecting these fees and redistributing them may be immense. And I think that's another thing that we certainly need to look at. Because whether it's by certainly not purposeful, but in essence, it is supporting that administrative fee is supporting a lot of judicial branch employment and other employment through that administration fee. And so I think that's one of the things that we really need to look at. There's, and I don't want to beat that to death, but there appears to be tens of millions of dollars of potential savings in streamlining that process.
And co-chairs and Senator Whitsett, we'll talk a little bit more about revenue administration implementation, but there's no doubt that dedicated, when a fee is dedicated to a specific purpose, it's a lot easier to track. And what we're trying to do is assemble a database of existing fees, which are dedicated for specific purposes and where they go and how they're accounted for, so that we can come back to the committee and be able to respond more specifically about the various fees and assessments you'll be looking at.
Thank you.
with that.
Any other questions? Otherwise, John, we'll move on.
Thank you, Seth. With that, we're on the third category, revenue and administration, which includes distribution and collections. So the core principles would be statute should aid in efficient revenue administration. Revenue administration should be based on modern business practices. Revenue administration should be based on high collectability and low cost of collection. And revenue distribution should be transparent. The key policy questions that arise from that would be, what are the barriers to efficient administration? Are revenue obligations easily collectible? Are distributions easy to identify and administer? What are the cost and benefits of establishing an amnesty or and or debt forgiveness programs?
John, go into a little bit more explanation about how these fees are going to be collected. Who's going to be collecting them? What kind of oversight does the legislature have? Every time I see a printout of what people owe the state of Oregon that has not been collected, some of it 10, 15, 20 years old, you're never going to collect it. It just makes me sick because if it were our money, we would not allow people to owe us. That just isn't the way life works. When people owe you money, then you go after them to get them to pay their debt. And yet, in the state of Oregon, so are we going to do any better with this kind of collection?
Co-chairs and Senator Verger, this is an interesting discussion that we've had actually when our staff has got together. And Bonnie Savage of the Judicial Department is here, who does an exceptional job. But, you know, we've talked specifically about this, and this, you know, I think it's approaching $1 billion of receivables for the department, and how we can, you know, how this fits into the equation. She makes the good point, though, that some of this may look uncollectible, but that they do have, with their current practices and practices that can be approved, they are making advancements on some of these collection activities. So rather than, you know, perhaps thinking we need to write all that off, they are having some, their programs that they're getting in place are having some success, but we need to look at it in the entire context and look at it in particular if there are ways to better manage that level of delinquent accounts. So I hope I've answered your question.
Yes, you have. You have. Senator Whitson?
Thank you. Mr. Borden, in the research that I've done, and it's been pretty superficial, but it appears to me that the total amount owed to the state keeps going up each biennium. And as I recall, it's around $1.2 billion or something like that now, an uncollectible, you know, and I, there was a Freudian slip, and uncollected fees, those that are 20 to 50 years old are pretty much uncollectible unless it's been someone who's been in prison and they get out and you garnish either wages or something. But I mean, in the private sector, we're able to depreciate our accounts receivables, and after about 7 years, you can depreciate them down to zero. And after that point in time, if you actually collect them, you have to recover your depreciation. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that's from the IRS point of view, that's what those old accounts are actually worth, nothing. So I mean, from the standpoint, I think that if we're going to go after collecting, the first thing we should be doing is looking directly at the new accounts and handling them differently so they don't become old accounts. And then focus our efforts sequentially in reverse order for 1 year old accounts, 2 year old, 3 years, and not spend a great deal of effort. Because my guess is if you were to take a bundle of $500 million of accounts that are 20 years of age and older and try to get a private collection agency to look at them, they would laugh at you. They're not going to waste their time. Now, the Department of Revenue may have an opportunity to go after some, you know, some in tax refunds and so forth, and I don't minimize that. But generally speaking, those old accounts are history. We need to focus on the new accounts and collect them as they come along instead of adding them to the list.
And if I may, co-chairs and Senator Whitsett, I think the department is going to be able to come forward when we discuss that particular thing with some very innovative business practices that they're currently undertaking, and part of that is aggressively going after those initial ones, because you're absolutely right, just like with any business, the longer you wait, the more difficult and costly collections are. So they have some practices that they're getting in place to go after collections early and try to get those taken care of. But it's not an easy task. So I hope in that particular agenda item, we'll see exactly what they're doing in that on that front and then how it can be improved. Because it definitely, the problem starts magnifying as those accounts continue to go uncollected.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This is a topic that I've had great interest in and a number of discussions with this department and also Department of Revenue. There are a few things that I want to mention, and this is just from memory from a half a year and 2 years ago, but I know I have read something that was either a proposed policy option package or a concept paper, perhaps, for how the department would improve on its collection rate. So I know that these plans have existed and they're already taking steps, even though we weren't able to fund, you know, some of the great ideas that they had, that they were able to start taking steps on how to improve the rate of collections. As I've discussed the issue of how much is owed to the state of Oregon, there are a couple things I'd like to make sure we understand. Everyone knows that you can say something keeps going up every year, but it's relative to what? For example, if it's money, if the value of money this year is more than the value of money 10 years ago, maybe it's really not more than it used to be. You know, so you have to do inflation-adjusted costs. But it's also, you know, relative to what? Relative to the amount that we billed, and maybe we're billing more now, relatively more now than we used to bill. So I'd need to understand the context of this. Do we have more people in default, but did, you know, are we part of that story? It's interesting to me that some of the improvements depend on, it's not just what we do as a state, but across counties there were such different practices, and across departments it may take some more legislative work. I know we've done some of that to make sure departments are even allowed to share information with each other. So if someone had gotten charged by a court and it was in this county, and now they're living in that county, and no one knew about it. In some cases, we needed enabling legislation to allow departments to even exchange information so that they could go after it. I hope you bring those barriers to us. If there's more things that are getting in the way, we need to fix those things. And then the last thing I remember hearing about is with regard to old accounts, whether you just write them off, for someone who owes money and they're in prison, they're probably not going to be paying the state back while they're still in prison. But after a half a year or a year of being employed again, after leaving prison, maybe this is someone who can start paying back on their debt. So collecting debt at the Department of Revenue and the age of the debt is different than the debts through this department, the way I understand it, and that we shouldn't give up on things just because they're a couple years old.
And if I may add, co-chairs, there's also a private sector component here too that they rely heavily upon. So there's kind of a three-legged stool here. The department works aggressively for collections that we need to hear, that the committee should hear more about. Works collaboratively with the Department of Revenue and other state agencies on their collection efforts, but then they also rely upon private collection firms. So there's a tiered approach here that would help enlighten it, but it really goes back to the type of fee structure and how that is established that may drive some of these collection issues. The complexity of adding more staff. The department's proposal was the revenue enhancement program that they brought forward during session, but that was adding significantly more staff. Perhaps that's necessary and that fits, but maybe there's better ways to do it. So.
All right.
Category number four is implementation. Revenue administration should be consistently administered across courts. Court user opportunity costs must be minimized. So those court opportunity costs would be such things as the public and private attorneys using the system, should not have to wait around for services or other things. So the key policy questions would be, are statutorily administrative revenue structures easy to access and administer? What are the technical and or administrative barriers to efficient administration? What are the statutory or other barriers to efficient administration? Is there a uniform and consistent implementation of fees across state courts? And how can user opportunity costs be minimized?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Craig.
I'd just like to comment here that in this area, this is an area that will be greatly affected by the Chief Justice's eCourt program, because one of the thrusts of that program is to bring in a new financial management system, which will be much more efficient, to create web presences where people can pay obligations very efficiently. We're piloting some of those things now, and we think that those will help tremendously. And so in talking about Mr. Boyden's issue here, it's right on point, is we really need to reduce all of the barriers for people who want to pay us money to get money to us, not make them drive to the courthouse, not make them wait online or on the telephone for long periods of time for an operator. But really, the eCourt program does bring to us, it is our design and our vision, a lot of efficiencies in terms of collecting revenue. So I just want to keep that in front of you, because that's a very important program and it will help with this issue.
Good comments. Thank you. Senator Whitson?
Thank you. Just to pile on that subject, I really strongly believe that we should be looking at trying to streamline the administration process before we apply eCourt to it, as opposed to building an eCourt system that tries to streamline an archaic process.
Co-chairs and Senator Whitsitt, that has been part of some very good discussions between especially our office and our IT specialist, Bob Cummings, in the department about how eCourt will modernize their existing business practices. It's just not information technology, but it's modernizing their whole way they do business. And one other thing about eCourt, too, is that speaks to Representative Nathanson's point, is, you know, part of that is the development of a person-based linking system.
Yeah.
So that's key technology to better track people and make sure that they are who they say they are and can collect revenue from it. With that, the last category is revenue restructuring. The core principles: a revenue structure should be simple and easily understood by court users. The judicial branch should have adequate and stable funding. The key policy question: should the judicial branch be partially or primarily supported by fees for service? If yes, what components or services should be fee supported? Should the judicial branch be primarily supported by general fund? Should the current statutory fee structure be simplified? Should overall fees be reduced? If so, how should the effect on the general fund be minimized? Should collection and delinquent obligations be an executive branch function?
Questions? Representative Garrett.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. This may just be a comment on the key policy questions. Maybe it will go into the best practices column, but after some of what we reviewed today about how the diversion of revenues depends on what officer of what unit of government pulled you over where, I would think one principle we might want to consider following is that we shouldn't have government units in competition with each other trying to generate money for their own government functions in a way that may seem arbitrary, random, and unfair to citizens of the state. I'm not sure it makes sense to have revenues allocated based on whether I was pulled over by a trooper or a sheriff and at whose instructions they're following about where the court, which court should have jurisdiction over this based on considerations of revenue versus other considerations. Not very articulately put, but that's my point.
Very good. I think you've made your point very well. I want us to have a good discussion on this and a little bit about where we're going to go, and then I'm going to ask the judge that is in the audience to come up and talk to us, and we're going to talk a little bit about municipal, and we'll talk a little bit about some of your comments, Representative Garrett. Senator Whitson?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just an observation in looking at these in these five major policy categories, and you may have mentioned this earlier, but it seems to me they're kind of upside down. It seems like five should be the, or number five really has the basic questions in it, and maybe we should be looking at that first to frame the response to all the other four.
I looked at that too. I thought that same thing. John, what is your vision of you and your staff of where we go from here with this work plan? In other words, we have the key questions, so we want to answer them. And so, how do you think that should take place?
Co-chairs and Senator Verger, I think that these key questions would be. Help staff set agendas and help us start doing staff work to prepare for those agendas and alert members of the bar and the public and others that you would want to solicit public testimony from. And so we would essentially work off this column B to establish agendas for the next five meetings, or, you know, if we could work that quickly. And go from there. So, is that make sense to you?
Representative Nixon, you want to make any comments on that particular point?
The timing is interesting to me because, as has been pointed out, we need to keep moving rather quickly to meet our goal of a recommendation for the next legislative assembly. If we take up one of these over each of five meetings, at some point, though, we're going to start hearing early, if not recommendations, maybe options from the report that we've commissioned, the study that we've commissioned. I'm wondering if we need to do this a little more quickly rather than over time, because it seems like the answers to these questions will influence which options we may choose for a recommendation.
The committee members have any objection to our starting with the fifth section rather than the first? It just seems to me that it just makes sense, and I was glad that Senator Woods had brought it up. Senator Bottomici.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I don't have any objection to that. I am a little concerned about the notion that we might be talking about these in five discrete meetings because they're so connected. That I would suggest that we move forward when we have our meetings, looking at all of this together and get as far as we can in each meeting. I think it's going to be too hard to talk about one without the other. I don't know if that, hopefully that doesn't make it too inconvenient from people who are coming to testify about the different things, but it seems like they're so connected that it's going to be hard to talk about one without the others.
Madam Co-Chairs, what we were particularly concerned about was making sure that the foundational information was available to the committee before the decision-making process started. And so the way that this is currently structured, it's designed to deal with all of the foundational pieces and then get to the answers to the questions in number five. And the number five is really the overarching, it's the overarching issues that this committee is dealing with. But there are, as you've seen from today, a number of foundational kinds of detailed issues that we're going to have to deal with. For example, just on the issue of violations and traffic citations, you've got the CFAA structure, you've got unitary assessment within that, you've got a lot of complexity that's got to be looked at before you can say we need to deal with this in this way. And so what we were trying to do is lay out a work plan that enables the committee to understand all of the issues that they're going to need to, that you're going to need to understand in order to reach the decisions that are included in number five. And certainly this isn't the only way to do it. This was just our attempt at imposing some organization on the process of getting to the decision making. So,
well, I appreciate that, Robin, I really appreciate the fact that I think you're trying to keep us very focused and trying to categorize things so that we don't wander all over the earth
right.
on trying to come to a very complex situation. I think that by going with five, we handle the basic things. We're not going to make a recommendation coming out of that, but we're going to start right off making some fairly good determinations so that, back to my earlier point, that we don't want to start looking at all these little fees and then later on down the road find out we spent all that time talking about something we're not even going to have in the recommendation at all. And so, but you know, we can certainly talk about that, and with the help of Aaron and working with the co-chairs, we can certainly figure out the agendas. We might even be able to combine a couple of these to Representative Nathanson's point of moving faster. When the study comes, that's going to change the dialogue. When the projections come, that's going to change it a bit. And just living is going to change it. We're just coming along and every day, because we don't know what's going to happen while we're having these discussions. And so, and I think we have other resources. I think the Chief Justice will be a resource. I think there'll be other groups. There are other groups that are talking about things, kind of sidebars, that are going to affect some of this. And hopefully they will be giving us input, whether it's the bar or whether it's a group that the Chief Justice is looking at about courts. And so I think that will make a big difference. So I think I understand where we need to go. So we'll be working with the staff and figuring out agendas and moving forward. Thank you very, very much, John.
Thank you.
I'll share another comment.
Okay, comment from Senator Whitson.
The other thing I think needs to be tracked is this initiative petition, IP64. The people might take care of this themselves, and it depends on whether petition gets enough signatures to get on the ballot and what the effort is to control it. But at 3% of our current general fund would be about a $420 million allocation to the judicial branch. And by 2015, I think if my memory serves me right, it would be about $510 million. 3% of that proposed general fund revenue. So that's another thing I think we should be tracking along the way and keeping in mind, because as the co-chair just mentioned, we're looking at the, if we spend our time in the minutia, which we may have to do, and then it's actually the people of Oregon vote to spend 3% on the judicial branch, then the whole thing becomes moot.
Co-chairs and Senator Whitson, that's correct. Your staff, Aaron, in particular, is tracking that. We're trying to look at the impact of that particular one. And as always, you're right on with your numbers. But I think the bottom line is that the fee structure, you know, this committee has a charge from the measure coming out of 2287 for its longer-term charge for the 2011 session. And so the timing of those two events, we'll probably have to, the committee will probably have to continue on with this. And the bottom line is if that petition, whatever happens with that petition, the fee structure will probably have to be modified. So,
well, we can certainly take that into consideration, though, in the discussions, and we should.
Yes.
So we should look at it if it passes, and we should look at it if it doesn't pass.
Okay.
And then that way, we've done that with other things a lot of times. So
there are a lot of moving parts here.
So that works. And all right, well, thank you, John.
Thank
and
you.
We are running a little early. We've moved along well. And so Judge Limhout, would you come forward, and we'll have some good discussion about municipal courts, and maybe you can enlighten us on traffic fines and somebody else deciding where we have to send the money. You'll identify yourself for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Berger and Nathanson, members of the committee. I'm Jad Limhouse, Justice of the Peace for Linn County. I also exercise the powers, duties, and jurisdiction for seven cities that are located within Linn County, and four of which are processed through the Justice Court, three of which, yes, would you see those? Mine's the one on top here. Yeah, thanks. Three of which have freestanding municipal courts over which I preside as a Justice of the Peace sitting as municipal judge. I've prepared a number of documents for you that I think are going to be passed out. I wasn't quite sure what kind of information would be useful. I got an email from Ms. Seiler that indicated that you're interested in something about jurisdiction, and so I prepared a document, a two-page document that looks like this. It has the outline of Linn County, and it one of them is for criminal jurisdiction and shows the jurisdiction, overlapping jurisdictions of the circuit, justice, and municipal court in Linn County. It tells you a little bit about what each of these courts do. These are just general summaries. It's just a one page that you can look at and see what the courts do. A municipal court, as you understand now, only exercises jurisdiction within the city limits. Anything that occurs with outside the city has to be filed either in a justice court or a circuit court. Justice and circuit courts have basically countywide jurisdiction within the county in which they sit over all criminal actions. One of the things that justice courts used to do that we very seldom do anymore is arraignments in felonies and pretrial proceedings in felony actions. The last justice court to regularly handle those matters was the Baker County Justice Court, and that stopped in about 2005 or 2006 when the county could no longer afford to pay for the indigent defense for felony cases proceeding before the Justice of the Peace. Now, these felony pretrial proceedings are usually done only in special circumstances when there is a circuit judge that is not available, because in some counties the circuit judge only comes through once every couple of weeks. And so in those counties, the Justice of the Peace still does the felony criminal arraignments in a fair number of cases. I've also brought some documents that indicate how the revenue stream through municipal courts primarily, but also from justice courts, passes through the system to the state of Oregon. And so you'll notice that one of your documents is some material that I get from the Department of Revenue that shows the breakdown of payments made to the Department of Revenue to the criminal fine assessment account, to the intoxicated driver program fund, and to the law enforcement medical liability account. Now, presently, local courts, and when I say local courts, I'm talking about justice and municipal courts, pay about 23.3% of all the money paid to the criminal fine assessment account. They pay about 41.2% of all the money paid to the intoxicated driver program fund. They pay 55.4% of the money paid to the law enforcement medical liability account. And according to the last information that I have, they're paying about 53% of the money paid into the state court facility security account, which is used for the appellate courts and the state court administrator's office. The notion that local courts take all the revenue is simply not true. There's also a one-page document that shows and this is the one-page document. This document shows the revenue for the courts that I've been able to get data from, and there have been a fair number. I have data from about 30 municipal courts that's reflected in these numbers. From 1991, which is the year before the unitary assessment took effect, through 2009, and it tracks the percentages of the money that was paid to the state for the unitary assessment primarily, to the county for the county assessment, and to the city treasury, and also to the judicial department for the state court facility security account. You'll notice that prior to the imposition of the unitary assessment, which took effect in July of the year 1992, cities kept over 85% of the revenue that went through the municipal court. They now keep about 70% of that revenue on average. The rest of it goes someplace else. Now, most cities that operate municipal courts operate both criminal side as well as violation side courts. And when I say criminal side, I'm talking about prosecution of misdemeanor crimes. Three of the courts, municipal courts over which I preside as a justice of the peace sitting as a municipal judge, prosecute crimes. Two of them take them to jury trials. They pay all the costs, including the cost of the prosecutor, the cost of the jury, the cost of indigent defense. The only thing they don't pay directly is the cost of incarceration, but because those cities have a contract with the county for law enforcement services, that contract also includes the cost of incarceration of prisoners. Now, some of the larger cities, for example, on the document that I call the Golden Eggs document that I used to send to the various chairmen of Revenue, Ways and Means, and Judiciary, describes how, if you look on page 2 of that document, down about the 5th paragraph, in the first 10 years of the unitary assessment, the city of Springfield's total share of court revenue declined from 85.73% to 66.64% of court revenue. Now, during that 10-year period of time, the court revenue increased about $262,000. The city got to keep about $21,000 of those $262. The other $211,000 went to the state of Oregon, primarily for the unitary assessment. Now, the city of Springfield is one of the 10 largest cities in the state of Oregon. It operates a full-service misdemeanor municipal court. They hire the prosecutor, they hire the judge, the court staff. They pay the indigent defense bill. And they recently built a jail where they now house their prisoners. The only thing that the state of Oregon funds that's connected with law enforcement in the city of Springfield is the prosecution of felonies through the circuit court. Everything else is done at taxpayer expense. And when I say taxpayer expense, I'm talking about the city of Springfield taxpayer, not the state of Oregon taxpayer. The city of Springfield is keeping about 70%, more or less, of the revenue that passes through that municipal court. And I can tell you fairly certainly that the revenue that passes through that municipal court into the city general fund is not sufficient to operate the police department, the court, the jail, the prosecutor's office, the indigent defense budget. Now, the two cities in the city of Lynn, or in the county of Lynn, over which I exercise jurisdiction, the city of Harrisburg and the city of Brownsville, those cities lose money every year on the operation of their municipal court because they have to pay for prosecution costs, indigent defense costs, jury trial costs. Why do they do it? Why do they lose money? Why don't they just quit the court and send them all that stuff to the circuit court? Well, because their city council is concerned about the quality of life in the city. The cities, especially the city of Brownsville, didn't always do crimes in the municipal court. It used to be just a violations court. But in the 1990s, problems developed that the district attorney and the circuit courts simply weren't dealing with. And so the city council decided to reconstitute the municipal courts to handle crimes. And so they have been paying for it ever since. Now, you heard some testimony. Excuse me, Senator Berger.
Yes, our understanding from prior testimony is that most municipal courts actually don't handle crimes.
And that's simply not true. There are many that don't. And most of the courts that don't handle municipal courts are from small cities. Don't handle misdemeanors are from small cities. Now, there are exceptions. I believe the city of Kaiser, for example, is a pretty good-sized city that's quite close to the city of Salem. It's adjacent. And my understanding is that they do not prosecute misdemeanor crimes in the Kaiser Municipal Court. But again, the issue for the city fathers and council in Kaiser is the quality of life within the city. They need to be able to timely prosecute city ordinance violations, especially nuisance violations. You know how much time it takes to get a nuisance ordinance prosecuted in a circuit court in the state, especially a busy one? they couldn't afford the overtime to pay their officers to sit around the in the circuit courthouse waiting for trials on traffic offenses. You know how long it takes to get trials? I recently was in a courtroom in the Linn County Circuit Court. There were, in that courtroom, I was a witness in a violation offense trial. There were two sheriff's deputies that were involved in that trial. And during the conduct of that trial, there were three OSP troopers that were sitting waiting for the trial that they were going to have later that afternoon. A good part of the officer time that is spent in the circuit court is waiting for something to happen. You walk in the halls down the circuit courtroom and in the circuit court in Albany, and you'll see lots of officers in uniform or in civvies waiting to give testimony. Where there are municipal courts and justice courts, the officers don't have to wait. We generally are able to process those cases right away. That's all we do for the most part. It's misdemeanors, violations, small claims, FEDs. We set them up so that one officer is given an hour of time. We set five or six trials for that one officer. He or she comes in and does the trial, goes out. The next officer comes in at his or her time, another three or four or five trials, that officer time's done. Next officer comes in. We do this on a regular basis. This is all we do. We do it efficiently. Our costs are low. You've heard some testimony about maybe it's a Clackamas County court that was recently established, and that the sole purpose is, of course, to generate revenue for the county. Well, I'm not going to tell you that revenue is not a factor. It probably is. I mean, why could it possibly be a factor? Well, it's a factor because the local courts operate at a lower cost. We don't have typically the judges that are in the municipal courts and justice courts are part-time judges, so they don't receive a full-time salary. They generally don't receive full-time salary benefits. The court staff is not paid as well as the staff at the circuit courts are. They're probably just as efficient and just as well trained. They just don't get paid as much because they're paid according to local standards, not Multnomah County standards. So our operating costs are much less. I have a justice court in Linn County. I have countywide jurisdiction. I hold court in Harrisburg, in Lebanon, and in Sweet Home. I have six full-time staff and one part-time staff. My total operating budget for this year is just a little over $600,000. How much does it cost you for one circuit court judge? More. More. It costs you more. Even if you send all those violation offenses to a hearings referee or a pro tem judge, it still costs you more because you've got more costs built into the system. The one thing that I've heard a lot about revenue, but I haven't heard anything about cost. How much it costs you to do the job. That's why cities and counties operate their own courts. And I'm really using the term own with respect to justice courts advisedly. We're really state courts. Everything we do is regulated by statute. The only thing the counties have to do with us is you have granted them the authority to establish us. You've given them the authority to provide an office and a staff. And you've given them some responsibilities that they have to fulfill. Otherwise, the legislature has plenary authority over the justice courts in the state of Oregon. By the way, we've been in Oregon since an act of parliament brought us here in the 1820s. The first
Judge,
justice of the peace.
Senator Whitsitt has a question for you. Yes. Senator Whitsitt.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Your Honor, this is very interesting information, very worthwhile. One of the things that jumps off the page at me, however, is on your municipal court revenue. You've gone from a 1991 figure of $891,000 into 2009 of $13,372,000. That is a 14-fold increase in revenue in only 18 years. And that certainly is not indicative of the population of Oregon.
No.
So could you explain what the factors are there?
Yes, Co-Chair Berger and Nathanson, Senator Whitsitt, the data that you see reflected on the single page is the data that I've been able to collect from various courts, and there's only about, I think, maybe two or three courts that are reflected in this 1991 figure. The numbers of courts increase until we get up to about 2000, or the year 2000, when we finally got about 30 courts reporting data, and we've the 2006 figure was the last year from which I had a full, what I call a full report from all the courts that had previously reported. Because of a staffing issue, I had to let the thing go for a while, and so we've now got the staffing issue temporarily resolved, and so the 2007, 2008, and 2009 numbers are the latest that I have. I have some additional courts to receive reports from, but the numbers from about year 2001 forward are from about 30 municipal courts of all sizes.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right. Continue.
I guess the message that I want you to take away from all this material is, number one, is that justice and municipal courts are important contributors to the administration of justice and in the state of Oregon. Most of the people in the state of Oregon who, outside of Multnomah County, who deal with courts, deal with a municipal court or a justice court. We're the court that most folks deal with. If you live outside of Multnomah County and you're cited into a court, the likelihood is it'll be either a justice or a municipal court. And so what we're doing is actually, we're not necessarily doing the heavy lifting. What we do is complementary and supplementary to what the circuit courts do. Make no mistake about it, the circuit courts are critical. And making sure that the circuit courts are adequately funded and properly staffed is critical to the operation of and administration of justice in the state of Oregon. But an equally critical part are the municipal and justice courts that are serving the people in the communities in which they live. There was recently published a book called Muni Court by a judge from a couple of small cities, and he's a lawyer judge, as I am, a couple of small cities in Jackson County. If you have an opportunity to read that book, Judge Bloom's book, do so, because it gives you a good bird's eye view of the kinds of things that justice and municipal courts do on a daily basis. I hold court almost every day someplace in Linn County. I take first appearances on crimes and violations almost every day someplace in Linn County. When people need to see the judge, they see the elected constitutional judge in Linn County, me. They don't have to go to a hearings referee. Generally, they don't see a pro tem unless I have to be someplace like today, someplace other than my courtroom. They see the elected judge, the one that they set in office. I'm a countywide elected official.
Judge Limhouse, thank you for your testimony, and I know that you're here primarily to talk about what you do and the municipal courts and the justice courts, but I wonder if you would like to add any comments to Representative Garrett's concerns about governments being competitive and competing with each other and not perhaps, as this committee is charged with, looking at how we fund a court system that really meets the needs of Oregonians, and also the fact that if you are stopped in Linn County by the sheriff and you go to one place or write your check to one place if you have a traffic violation. And I'm sure you heard his questions. Would you like to comment on any of that?
Well, that's a kind of a difficult question to respond to from a number of aspects. The system that we have is one that has historically evolved, and it is somewhat fragmented. But on the other hand, because it's not a totally unified system, we actually have some economies that are built into the system such that if certain kinds of activities are focused on in certain areas, in certain courts, then that's probably, you gain some efficiencies. What I'm trying to get at is that the paradigm that we're kind of working against here is the paradigm to centralize everything into one particular place, one particular agency. And typically what happens in that circumstance is inefficiency. the somewhat fragmented system that we have presently, one of the reasons why it works as well as it does is because there is really the opportunity to go to some place that's close to you to deal with these kinds of issues that are most common. You don't have to go to a central place, pick a number, and wait in line. It doesn't take weeks or months to get things done. The criminal actions and the crimes that proceed in my municipal and justice courts, we have them done within 4 to 6 months from the first appearance to the jury trial. We're done. Quick. It's over. The small claims, the FEDs, we have a short window. Things are done quickly, and so we're able to gain some efficiencies because we're somewhat fragmented in that we're available. We're accessible. The Bar Association, the National Bar Association, has this Access to Justice program. And basically what they're trying to do is provide lawyers for people. Well, what I'm trying to convince you is it's just as equally important to provide courts for people to go to, not just lawyers, but courts. And the system that we have now does that. We have municipal courts that people can go to deal with most of the things that happen within a city. We have justice courts that people could go to for the same purpose, for the things that most people have to go to and deal with in a particular area. I don't hold court in the county seat. That's what the circuit court does. I don't care about being in the county seat. I'm a small town guy. I prefer to be in a small town. I don't want to be in the county seat. I hold court in three different communities that are miles away from the county seat. Harrisburg's 27 miles away. Lebanon's about 14 miles away. Sweet Home's about 28 miles away. Brownsville, one of the municipal courts, is 25. Halsey, one of the other municipal courts, is about 18. It's important for people to be able to go to the local court to deal with those issues and not have to go some distance. The county seat in Linn County is in the northeast county of the state, where a lot of folks live there, but that's not the only place people live. There's lots of other folks that live miles away. Why do we want to have to make all those folks have to go to the county seat, Mr. Garrett? Is there a reason why we want to do that? I don't know. I don't think there is. I think we want to let folks be able to have access to justice where they are. I guess that's the...
Well, thank you very much for being here. Yes, Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. In your, on this particular chart you had it
yes.
up here, just to clarify, in civil jurisdictions, if the amount in question is more than $750, do you have the capacity to have a jury trial?
Yes, we do jury trials in civil actions.
Okay, and do you do that also in criminal and misdemeanor?
No, the district attorney does not prosecute cases to crimes in justice court. The district attorney wants to have all those actions filed in the circuit court, and so if we have to, I handle about 500 crimes a year in the justice court. We have the first appearance, give the person an opportunity for either indigent defense counsel or privately retained counsel. We set the matter for a pretrial conference. We go to the pretrial conference. If the individual decides that he or she wants to have a trial, then the matter gets transferred to the circuit court. Of the 500 cases, there's more or less that I handle every year, less than 50 transferred to the circuit court for trial. Most of them are resolved at the pretrial conference.
Well, Your Honor, you had to make a sacrifice to come today, and I want to take note of that because obviously somebody may have seen a referee because you were gone. And so we appreciate your being here, Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I've written many notes based on your discussion. The takeaways for me, some of them are decreased time, so quicker resolution of case, increased convenience, decreased cost, decreased impact on law enforcement officers' time, increased enforcement of quality of life laws and ordinances. Some of those things I think are really critical. One of the other things you mentioned, though, is that we hadn't talked about the cost here. One of the underlying points for me, however, is the cost of the system of fees that we happen to have established over time. And I am concerned not with removing all the benefits of access, local access to courts in the system that you described, the benefits of that. Rather, it's a matter of what is the best way to provide the bureaucracy, if you will, or the most cost-effective administration of our judicial system in Oregon. And all of these surcharges and fees that we've established over years and years and years, dozens, hundreds, you know, of lines in binders, trying to manage that is very costly. And one of the assumptions that I'm making, and I haven't been persuaded that it's wrong yet, is that the way we've established all these individual fees or assessments, whatever we're calling fees, I guess, and surcharges, that in itself is way too costly. And is there a different way of establishing a much simpler set of fees where everybody still comes out okay? We're trying to keep everyone whole, I guess you might say, as much as possible. It's not about changing who gets how much money. It's about, can we administer the system in a smarter and less costly way? So that's much of what our discussion is going to be about.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nathanson. Those were good comments. All right, we have, we're running right close to time, and we have one more agenda item, which is the next steps. And I see that Aaron has given us a map with some dates marked on it, and I'll bet you want us to talk about that. Is there some reason that we're not meeting in concert with the legislative days?
Madam Co-Chair, on the calendar before you, we have gone through and identified dates during the non-legislative months to begin with. We will be meeting during legislative days. I'd like to make the suggestion and solicit some feedback whether or not there's a prefer to meet in one large block at the end or the beginning of the legislative day week, or to try to meet a couple evenings a week for 2 hours after meetings during the regularly scheduled day, so a meet from 5 to 7. Therefore, no members have to stay at the end of the week if they have other commitments. And that's why it's not highlighted on your calendar, because I wanted to solicit some feedback on that suggestion first. And depending on that outcome, we will then identify the appropriate days or days to meet during the legislative weeks in May, September, and December. Primarily, what we've gone ahead and identified 2 days at the end of each month that would be the preferred meeting dates. If there is a reason that we should maybe look at other dates, I'd like to know that information also. But understanding the scope of our charge, we have identified dates each month and do plan to meet each month right up until 2011 session begins. And that a couple key dates that I did not put on the calendar quite yet is we will be having in April the NCSC, the National Conference, here to give their preliminary report. And they will also be back in September to give their final report. And so what we would like to do for the next meeting is to present you not just with a complete work plan, but with a complete calendar of all the meeting dates throughout the end of interim, and primarily concerned with identifying the April meeting date today. And then if everybody would like just to get back to me on the remainder of the calendar before the next meeting, that would be great. So the 2 dates we're looking at in April is the 29th and 30th. And just if everybody has their calendar with them, just look at those 2 dates.
Just while I'm getting my calendar out, when is Thanksgiving? I'm looking at this 22nd, 23rd.
Thanksgiving is the end of that week, 25th, 26th. And if there'd be a if people would prefer to come back on the 29th and 30th, we can certainly look at that. Or if people are going to be gone that full week, we can look earlier too.
Well, I don't know about other people, but usually I'm chief cook and bottle washer, uh-huh. And so that works it really hard
okay.
for me.
Are you asking for responses
yes,
right now?
Yes, please.
And Aaron, are you talking about the mornings, afternoon?
Well, still? It's largely dependent upon your schedules. We haven't set the mornings. So let's determine which date works best, 29th or 30th, And then if morning or afternoon?
I'm now scheduled to be out of town both those days.
Okay.
So if those are the days, it needs to be work around me.
Okay.
It would take me out of it.
30th works better for me.
Okay.
The Board of Bar Governors meeting on the 30th, so I would not be able to make
okay.
it yet.
I'm free on both, but the 29th would be better than
okay.
the 30th.
Aaron, was it your intent to have two meetings in April, one for the report and one for this?
No. They would be here for our one meeting. It'd be a one meeting.
Okay. Whatever day we choose, they'll
be. Yeah, exactly. Okay. And that's part of why I would like to know today, because they would like to be able to make their travel arrangements, too.
I'm open both days,
okay.
but the 29th would be better for
okay.
me.
Okay.
Madam Co-Chair, if we're going to have that report on the same day as the meeting, I'm envisioning we might want to set aside 4 hours with a very short break in the middle.
So we'll have a meeting and the report.
They'll be part of our agenda on that meeting
date. On that meeting day.
We'll just build in some extra time where we've met for 4 hours today. We'll probably meet, for 3 hours today, we'll probably meet for four and a half.
I think the co-chair is exactly right.
Mm-hmm.
You probably want 4 hours with a break in the middle.
29th? It looks like 29th appears to be, with the exception of Representative Garrett, who will be out of town, appears to be the best day. Does that sound appropriate?
Does 30th work for you?
Neither one. So.
Neither one.
Okay.
Is there a time that works better for everyone, morning or afternoon?
Afternoon's better for me. I can make mornings work if that's preferred.
I'm flexible. I would just like to know.
Well, I think we're looking at April 29th. Why don't we plan for April 29th, 1 to 5? All right. And then ask for the remainder of the calendar. If you just want to send an email back to me with the identified dates, that way we can generate a full calendar for everybody before our next meeting, and that will assist in just long-term planning and everybody being prepared.
What does the committee think about Aaron's question about whether to meet during legislative days twice in the evenings or stay for the days? I'm very leery of scheduling evenings.
Okay.
Because sometimes we have long meetings
exactly.
with Ways and Means.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And some of us commute. It's better have
and,
a
yeah, and you commute.
And
I think that's
okay.
awfully hard.
And then that's what I was interested in finding out. And so then I will just plan to find a date. Probably looking at the May calendar on the 27th in the afternoon. There is a joint revenue meeting that morning, and one of our members does serve on that because the revenue forecast will be coming out. So I think tentatively we're looking at the 27th in the afternoon, and then similarly in September will be another revenue report, and we'll be meeting probably in the afternoon of the 23rd.
Of which month?
Of September.
Okay.
We're set then for April 29th. And then I also just wanted to take note that Senator Whitsitt brought up IP 64. And I have been tracking it. And I just wanted to let everybody know that currently the ballot title is pending appeal to the Supreme Court. Upon receipt of the new ballot title, it will go out for signature gathering. And they are aiming for the general election of 2010. So if it passes or fails, we will know prior to when our report is due. And so that is all I have for you, Madam Chair.
Time for the meeting on the in May 27th?
1 to 4, tentatively. And we may adjust a little bit longer depending on what our agenda looks like, so maybe 1 to 5.
Okay, is that it, Erin?
Yes, it is.
All right. Co-Chair Nathanson, any comments?
No, this
today?
Is a very full meeting, and it's been a really interesting discussion. Thank you very much.
Very good. Committee members, any comments? All right. I want to thank the staff again for the work that you've done for the meeting today. Thank you very much for the telephone conference call that enables us to do our work and still stay in the district. So I greatly appreciate that as well. And with that, I'll call the meeting adjourned.